And now on Radio Flange Goblet, it's the Permanent Ruptures on My Face Gun of the Month Club, starring Ernie Hudson and a wind-up cockatiel named Simon.
Are we really doing this again?
What do you mean?
Well, every week it's just wall-to-wall silly names. What? There's no good ideas anymore.
Look, it's been 73 shows already. This is number 74. What do people want for nothing? Jesus Christ!
Hello, Earthlings, with your strange love of the duck creature. I am Spoon being the man, and I am here to help you with your problem.
Wait, sorry. Did you say Spoon Bender Man?
Yes, tis I, terrifier of the plastic cutlery people of Omicretti 7, defeater of Uri Geller, doing guest appearance on Blank D Blank, and once, by bending a ladle, which is like a giant spoon, I was able to save the president of the pasta sauce nation of Barelli Major from drowning in himself.
So what? You bend spoons, then?
This is correct. I am Spoon Bender Man.
What about forks? Can you do forks?
Don't be ridiculous. Whoever heard of a fork bender, huh? I would be left out of Spoon Bender Guild on my home planet, Spoon Bendia, in the galaxy of...
Yeah, if I can just interrupt. It's just that spoon bending isn't exactly a great... oral experience. It's more visual, and this is radio. How does you, flying in here with your small pink booties, quiffed up toupee, and disturbingly tiny furry briefs, help us with our problem that we have no comedy intro for the aftermovie diner this week?
I am Spoon Bender Min. I am happy to serve. Whatever you need, I will achieve. I am savior of the once spoonless nation of Norsupia in the sad children nebula of Piffity Perfity.
How did you do that, then?
I provide my own spoons. Behold!
Right, I see...
There's a spoon.
But
there's another spoon. Well, spoons all around.
Wait a minute.
Spoons.
They're all bent.
Of course they are all bent. I am Spoon Bender Man.
Oh, of course. But why would the nation of Nosupia want bent spoons?
Look, is a bent spoon not better than no spoon when two-thirds of your world is made out of breakfast cereal?
He does have a point.
Shut up, Nigel, and go back to your I Want to Stop Pooping in Public self-help CD.
Sorry.
Now, wait a minute, Mr. Spoonbender Man.
You may call me Donald.
Okay, now wait a minute, Donald. I've had an idea. Do you play the spoons? We could possibly broadcast you playing the spoons.
No. I do not play the spoons.
Of course.
I bend the spoons. What about this concept does your inept earth mind not comprehend?
No, I understand. It just seems to be a very limited and, if you don't mind me saying so, wholly useless cutlery-based skill.
You would not say it was useless if you lived in the galaxy of curves and the bent spoon was the only way to eat pudding without excessive dribbling.
Well, maybe. I guess we're out of luck. Thanks for trying, but really, I think we're just done for.
Never fear, there is one more thing I can do.
What's that?
I can say, roll the theme music.
What does that sound like?
Roll the theme music!
All right, everybody, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Aftermovie Diner. The seats are hot, the drinks are cool, and the chat is racy. Yes, we're here yet again with me old chum, who, like myself last week, just had a birthday. Give it up for Mr. John Wallace.
Thank you. I should say that my seat is cold and my drink is hot, because once again it's freezing cold in London. The streets are alive with strange creatures. I was just out on the balcony having a cigarette, and a van pulled up and a man with mad big hair, not unlike True Believer James Woods' hair.
Nice.
Jumped out, grabbed a mattress from outside my house and leapt back into his van and sped off into the night.
Nice.
So at least Britain is full of entrepreneurs still. We're still an entrepreneuring nation where people will drive around all night in
right.
search of manky old mattresses.
In search of that one slice of gold in a sea of darkness. Yes, indeed. That's fantastic.
The mattress was so old that it sort of oozed over him when he picked it up.
Oh.
As opposed to bad, you know, bad.
Yeah, around. that's not something I want to imagine at all.
But I have come, and I'm ready to talk, and I could even talk about Peter Weller and James Woods.
If need be.
If need be,
here in our continuing saga of the Woods and Weller, which this week, my goodness, we're certainly doing Weller's most famous role. And as for the Woods film, I don't know how well bestseller is known, but I believe that amongst the people in with which it is known, it is popular. A small group of people living on the plains of Nebraska, no doubt, cowering under some tarpaulin and eating hedgehogs or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something which I've, which I was aware of before, certainly.
But it's written by Larry Cohen, who's one of my favourite writer-directors to come out of New York in the 70s, so...
Well, we were just saying that if you go on to... Because we're doing tonight RoboCop. We're doing 2 years... the Weller Woods year that was 1987.
Yeah, that was the year that was.
When Weller came out with RoboCop and Woods came out with Bestseller, we were just saying that the IMDb trivia page on RoboCop is ridiculous in its length. It goes on and on and on. And what I was about to say was that the really interesting stuff is the stuff about casting. There is some mad, mad casting trivia in there, isn't there?
Yeah, well, the one that I was most drawn to is the fact that Stephanie Zimbalist, which is a fantastic name, was originally cast... I have no idea who she is, was originally cast as Lewis, but had to give her the part when she was called back to film more episodes of Remington Steele. And what I wanted to point out was, considering Pierce Brosnan lost out the role of Bond due to Remington Steele, and she lost out the chance to be in RoboCop due to Remington Steele, was Remington Steele just roaming the Hollywood Hills, destroying people's careers? I mean, for a TV series that I don't know anyone who remembers it at all or watches it or particularly likes it, other than the references to Bond or whatever, they seemed to be real Nazis when it came to, well, no, you have got a contract, so I'm sorry, I'm going to pull you out of this multi-million-dollar picture and force you to do reshoots on some fucking episode of Remington Steele.
I know, but the things that drew me, but there were things in there about people who, what Weller was going to be cast as and what other people who, but apparently when Weller first started the show, I mean, you sent me, and, you know, I'm sure you'll post it on the Facebook page if you haven't already, the most brilliant talk that Weller gives after a screening of RoboCop, in which he, I mean, he seems to have become like a more lively individual as he's aged. I mean, I don't know what that's about. But he's shouting and screaming about all kinds of things. I have to say, very interestingly, and I really liked what he had to say, actually.
Yeah, I have posted that, yes, and I will probably repost it when this episode is about to go up.
It was saying that he, when he first went on the set of RoboCop, Verhoeven actually thought about getting rid of him because he bitched so much about how uncomfortable the suit was, which I think is extraordinary. Like, and you can imagine that Weller being upset about something would actually be quite a handful.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely, if his performance at this particular talk is anything to go by, considering he seems to have been violently upset by the fact that Denzel Washington in Training Day spends more time looking at Ethan Hawke than he does looking at the road, which seems to have upset Weller to a point of detonation almost.
Well, I thought it was really, really interesting. And if for people who haven't seen it, do look it up. It's him talking after a screening of RoboCop, and it's really worth looking at because he's a very entertaining speaker, very full of tics and movements, and he keeps on squeezing his eyes and arming and ahhing.
And at one point stands up and just starts wandering about.
Yeah, yeah. But I thought what the stuff he had to say about the life of... What was it? He was saying about the life of the place or something like that, about the importance of the what you're interacting with and the scene.
Right, yeah, the importance. Basically, I mean...
The physical life of the scene or something like that.
The physical life, yeah, because it's the two bits of the method, the physical and the emotional life, and it's the striving of trying to get it as real as possible, which is where the whole diatribe about driving scenes came from. because the old way to do it was to affix cameras onto a car and have the actor really drive. And then they've had various other ways of, like, yanking the car. There's now stunt drivers can sit actually in a metal casing on top of the car and actually drive the car while the actor fakes it. And, of course, the most popular use of it is the low rider, which is a basically like a flatbed truck that has the car on it and drives along and is filmed in such a way that, you know, hopefully it looks integrated with the rest of the road. But as he describes it, you know, looks like it's flying above the rest of the cars. And
yeah,
he was saying that the issue that he had with that was that when an actor doesn't have to really do something, the actor starts to think about all this other stuff. And in fact, the realism of the physical life of the scene is lost, i.e. yeah, Denzel Washington looking at Ethan Hawke rather than looking at the road.
And that really applies to what we were talking about like last year for a film like Screamers, because I think that really applies to, because he touches on it, and the example he uses is the way driving scenes are filmed. But he talks about how you lose a lot of the life of the scene through them, you know, acting at, you know, they, because they're not driving, they're not speaking realistically as you do when you're driving. And I think, and he touched on the fact that, like, how that extends to CGI. And, you know, the fact that when you've got someone, just like we were saying the other day, stood in front of a green screen, there is, by definition, no physical life to the scene whatsoever. Right. And that's why I think, you know, when you have big films like, you know, the Star Warses and things like that, where it's all shot on this green screen, you lose a lot. You lose a lot, you know, you lose a lot, and you cannot help but lose a lot. And there is no kind of actor who can, you know, who can create some physical life out of nothing. So I thought that was really, really interesting.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the other thing that came about, weird that we would be this many episodes into a Weller and Woods thing and not really have delved into it, but you know, finding out some great stuff just researching those clips this week about Weller, the fact that he teaches Italian art history at one of the colleges in New York, one of the universities in New York, I forget which one, I think it's Syracuse, I think he teaches at. And he has been on several art history shows for various different documentary channels. And he is a director of TV. He's directed House and directed Sons of Anarchy and some other shows. You know, and seemingly, although, you know, we were saying last time that they had this great run of films in the 80s and 90s and then has, you know, have sort of faded into the background somewhat in since the new millennium, you know, actually Weller has added multiple strings to his bow. I mean, seemingly, you know, doing lots of things. He's obviously now the voice of Batman as well in two incredibly lauded Batman animated.
I would have loved a Weller Batman.
Have been a great Batman after Keaton. He would have been a great Batman after Keaton.
Maybe too old, though, you see. Maybe too old.
I don't know, because he does, like, with Robocop, the stuff that he manages to do with his jaw, it's just, it's incredible. Yeah. And it was
jaw acting. He is the world leader in jaw acting. After
right. And it's fascinating to think that actually what he was saying.
Do you find that the colour of Robocop's lips just a little bit wrong? As almost as if they've picked up Robocop's lips.
It's a little obscene, yeah. But I think that's mainly comes down to the fact that you're just seeing the mouth, and that Weller has. Well, what it is, what I was going on to say is that, you know, and they've said on IMDb, one of the things they were thinking of was maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger, although A, it was too close to Terminator, and secondly, he was too big for the suit. What Weller was actually, the other thing I found out about him is he was a marathon runner in his heyday and apparently quite a successful one. And he was very thin and lithe, and you see that at the beginning of the movie. And they worked out that because the suit was so big and bulky, that you needed a thinner actor in a bigger suit rather than a big actor in an even bigger suit, because that just made them look ridiculous. And what's interesting about the mouth area of Robocop is that obviously because you've got this big helmet and these side panels, that makes his jaw look wider than it actually is, because there's no ears or hair or anything to put it into context. There's just this jaw locked off with this neck piece and a helmet. Because his lips are narrow, he doesn't have like a big wide mouth. He's got this kind of narrow, slightly dull mouth. It looks a little obscene in this sort of sea of flesh, just this little mouth yeah. opening and closing, and then this big metal thing around it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's maybe a trick of your eyes more than yeah. the reality.
But it's also, you know, another interesting bit of trivia was that he gave up, or he turned down Robocop 3 to do Naked Lunch, which we did last week. I mean, that, for me, that must have been an absolute no-brainer, to be honest right. with you.
Is Nancy Allen in all three?
I'm not sure, but isn't it extraordinary to think that they were even thinking about someone like Schwarzenegger for it? I mean, in a way, it makes sense, but it's almost more extraordinary that Weller got the role at all. I mean, he was no one big; he had no big films behind him at all. You know, he was a very, very much plucked from obscurity kind of a guy, which Verhoeven has, you know, has done quite a few times throughout his films. Yeah. To be fair. But it's a big, big, big break for him. And I think it kind of shows what a sort of one-off... I think it says something about the one-offness and special place the movie has, that it can't, that it wasn't part... It wasn't the first in a 10-long series of Peter Weller's amazing action career. It was a very peculiar piece of casting to suit a very particular film with a very particular... very particularly of its time.
Right. She is in all three... The actress and Nancy Allen, who plays, is it Anne Lewis she plays? Which, interestingly enough, Verhoeven, being the crazy person that he was like, okay, I will cast Nancy Allen, but she will cut her hair because I do not wish her to be sexualized in any way. And
I can think of that. That's been a concern for you, to be honest, Paul.
Yeah, it's about the only movie in which you're not like, please let us sexualize everything. As much as I possibly can. I'm surprised he wasn't like, I wish to sexualize Ronnie Cox. I mean, he almost does. Ronnie Cox's last name is Cox, and his character's first name is Dick. So, I mean, you know, anyway. So, do you want to do for...
His angry scenes opposite...
Miguel Ferrer?
Miguel Ferrer are, you know, they're so intense that you wouldn't be completely surprised if they just sort of locked into a passionate kiss.
there is a lot of, like, homoerotic, red-faced men in suits shouting, which is quite delightful in this movie. Everything is very, very important. In fact, Miguel Ferrer starts off, you know, on this sort of corporate-infused high about the idea of, like, yeah, this is what you can do, take your opportunities and all this sort of stuff. Right up into his, you know. So should we continue with RoboCop then? And then we'll end up on bestseller. There is a link between the two movies, though, apart from the year.
And what is that?
There is a thematic link. It's that technically... The link is that the evil machinations of corporations.
That's totally true. That's totally true.
Both movies, in their own way, one in a, let's say, 75% realistic way in the bestseller, because there's nothing fully realistic about it, because it's Dennehy and Woods.
It's an incredibly high score to give its realism criteria, if you ask me. I'm giving it 30 at best.
Meaning that there aren't robot policemen wandering around and there isn't, like, mutant...
That is more believable than bestseller. That is more believable than the bestseller.
But, yeah, the evil machinations of corporations, that's what that's going to be the very long-winded tagline to this episode.
We get the best of both worlds. The fastest reflexes modern technology has to offer, onboard computer-assisted memory, and a lifetime of on-the-street law enforcement programming. It is my great pleasure to present to you... RoboCop.
This guy's really good.
He's not a guy, he's a machine.
Old Detroit has a cancer. Cancer is crime.
Let the woman go. You are under arrest.
You better back up, pal.
Your move, creep.
What are your prime directives?
You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney.
What is this shit?
Anything you say may be used against you.
He's a cyborg, you idiot. He recorded every word you said.
You're dead. We killed you.
His memory's admissible as evidence.
You're gonna have to kill it.
Get in the car, for God's sake!
RoboCop, the future of law enforcement.
But did you want to run down RoboCop for us? For you know, the three people out there who haven't seen it.
Yeah, so RoboCop is the story of Peter Weller, whose parts role is called Murphy. Murphy has just joined a new precinct in future Detroit. It's a near-future dystopian sci-fi fantasy, which is my number one favourite. And Detroit is basically an exaggerated version of what it was in the 1980s, i.e. crumbling society with a very serious crime problem. And hanging over Detroit is this extremely powerful company that's headquartered there called Omnicorp, which is involved in, you know, at one point one of the people says what it's involved in, and it's hospitals, prisons, space, police, you know, it's all these things which no one else thinks can turn a profit, but Omnicorp managed to turn a profit out of through what are obviously not particularly good means or motives.
Yeah, military is another one.
Yeah, Murphy joins he says, we are the military. Murphy joins this new precinct, and pretty much on his first call out, is the victim of a particularly horrendous murder by the sort of leading kingpin in old Detroit, as it's referred to. And basically, he then is resurrected as this cyborg. Basically, they sort of, you know, pluck out gooey bits of his brain that are left and slam it into a cyborg along with his jaw. And he goes out onto
along
the street
with his face, which they stretch across his. They stretch his face stretch. Across a kind of.
So he goes out onto the streets and he begins to go to work, and then through various things that happen, which is basically lingering dreams he has and memories he has, he goes out for revenge, basically, on the people who killed him. That Weller interview screening we were talking about, which you should definitely look up. He is obviously very, very proud of it. And watching it again, I can totally see why. It does have a few serious problems as a movie, personally, which I think mostly actually come. I like Paul Verhoeven, but I do think that he makes sort of similar mistakes again and again in movies. But it's a really, really good one. And I think it's his best film by a wild distance. I mean, I just think it's easily his best movie. I really like Total Recall, but I do think this is far in advance of that. And I think that one of the most interesting things about it, apart from another, a very strange performance by Peter Weller, but a very good one, is what we were talking about as the theme, this theme of this sort of overhanging corporation. And I think I'm really, really pleased that they are so thematically strong, because what I was thinking was how striking it is that throughout RoboCop, one of the best things Verhoeven does is news broadcasts from the future, which he uses again in things like Starship Troopers and again in the Total Recall and movies like that. And in these news broadcasts, remember, this is at the absolute height of the Cold War. This is the ratcheted up, you know, face-off Cold War that Reagan initiated, the absolute height of that and of corporate greed.
Well, they even mention, don't they, in the news broadcast, the Star Wars project, which was actually something that was going on at the time.
Exactly, what links into that and what makes the film so interesting is that it doesn't, at no point in any of these news broadcasts is the Soviet Union mentioned. All the problems are basically America being at war with itself. They do mention there's a war in Mexico, but it's all the things that are on the news are, you know, the Star Wars platform, which is obviously a very Cold War relic, actually opens fire on America and like kills a load of ex-presidents. And there's this very strong message throughout it that the real danger is America sort of eating itself, and it's just a real, and you know, all dystopian near future sci-fis are like that, but it's done very, very well.
Yeah,
and those news broadcasters are so strange and brilliant. The guy, the news broadcaster, is such a strange guy with such a weird delivery, and I love those bits, and love that whole underlying theme of the movie.
But what's funny is, I mean, first of all, the first 30 minutes of the movie, in other words, the setup, is satire heavy, and it's really good satire. Like, it's really well done, everything you're saying. In the setup, they've crowbarred in as much of this, quite on the nose, actually, with hindsight, satire, which is brilliant. And that's sort of the stuff that I love the most, and sort of stuff that you see predominantly in something like a Brazil by Terry Gilliam or something like that. But what is fascinating about those news broadcasts is, apart from the slightly shonky looking set and the video quality and some of the effects, it's, you turn on Fox News or CNN or any of those today, and that's what it is. It's two people grinning at you in ridiculous sweaters or ties telling you that the world's ending, while grinning and being like, well, oh, yeah. How are you, Julia? Yeah. Oh, I'm fine, thank you, Smith.
Whatever. And they do little asides, like some cop who's been shot to ribbons by this Clarence Boddicker bloke is clinging to his life in hospital, and they go, good luck, Roy.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that was some of my favourite bits. It was fantastic. And the other thing is the reason why the RoboCop program even comes into being, which is headed up by a very excitable Miguel Ferrer, is that...
Who is awesome.
Who is awesome in this movie, is that Ronnie Cox's plan, which is, again, both satirical and hilarious, his plan, he's got these, big war machines, basically, that are these... I mean, fantastically well-done, stop-motion animated, big robotic cannons with this huge head and whatever that comes trudging into this boardroom at the beginning. The satire behind it is that you hear Ronnie Cox later, after it's malfunctioned and killed one of the board members, Ronnie Cox says to Miguel Ferrer later on, he says, it doesn't matter if it didn't work or not, we were just going to get money for putting them into production, which is what happens with all the war machine right now, is that there's all these defense contractors just churning out weapons and planes and shit that no one's ever going to use. Doesn't matter if they work, doesn't matter if they backfire, doesn't matter. It's all about just making the money off the production of it and so on and so forth. And so that was a really good line in the movie. But it's sick, but at the same time, hilariously sick, that on the first time they even try it out, it malfunctions horribly. And, guns down one of the board members. Now, you'd think that there would have been, tests carried out in bunkers somewhere with dummies or animals or anything. But no, Ronnie Cox just marches this thing into a boardroom and has been so confident and egomaniacal is he with this ridiculously overblown war machine that he's planning to just let loose on the city of Detroit. That he tries it out in the boardroom and ends up killing someone. But no, yeah. I liked that satire and everything that was woven into that. I really did. I thought that was on point.
Yeah, and it's just, you've got to give Verhoeven credit for... Verhoeven, interestingly, another IMDb trivia thing, his wife was actually the one who persuaded him to make the film. He read the first few pages of the script after it had been sent around a lot of people turned it down. He picked it up, didn't like it either. Wife picked it up, had a read and said, actually, I think there's quite a lot more to this and you should have a look at it, which is why he went back and decided to do it.
The wife said, all those newsroom parodies you keep telling me about at night? Well, yeah. You can actually crowbar them in this one.
I think that's what's so good is that he's you could get way too pleased with yourself about how cool those little news broadcasts are and those little scene-setting things that he has. Like, also the really famous thing that runs throughout the film is the I buy that for a dollar guy, who is this sort of very Benny Hilly kind of figure, this horrible, rancid little creep who keeps on, sort of nuzzling his face in the ample bosoms of sort of these blonde goddesses who are all covered in cream and yelling, I'll buy that for a dollar at the screen and getting, so many laughs for it. Like, every time you see anyone watching it throughout the world of RoboCop, they're always absolutely killing themselves with laughter at it. No one doesn't find it funny. It's this vacuous, empty, Benny Hill-esque you know, nonsense. But he'd never too pleased himself, and he doesn't overdo it. He also has done, as we were saying earlier on with Peter Weller, he's done the most fantastic casting job in it. I mean, it is the sort of pinnacle of B-movie people being brought in doing extraordinary jobs in particular roles that they become almost, like, seminal for. Like, Miguel Ferrer. I mean, Miguel Ferrer, interestingly, another IMDb fact, when they cast him, they actually slightly did some rewrites because they went, he's coming across as too likeable. So I think we're going to have to rewrite it to make him a little bit more likeable because people just like him when they see him on screen. They got the guy playing Clarence Boddicker, whose name is...
Kurtwood Smith.
Kurtwood Smith, who does a gazillion other roles as a sort of, you know, slimy creature, or a sort of... he appears in quite a few things as someone who's wrong about something, like someone in the government who has the wrong idea about something or other.
Well, he appears with James Woods in True Believer.
Right, yes, absolutely, yes. He's a slimeball creep back there. It's another bloody amazing link between these two geniuses of the silver screen. And he's also got Ronnie Cox does the most brilliantly slimy and sort of psychotic, chief exec role. And then the guy who is the owner of the company does a brilliantly brilliant turn, which is very easy to take for granted, but he's this... very sort of grand old man who's the head of the company, and they all refer to him as the old man and everything. And after this, Ed 209 Uber Killbot blows this guy away in the middle of the boardroom, and, you know, it's this utter disaster. Instead of, like, saying, he's killed a man, you know, or saying anything like that, he just says, I'm very disappointed.
And that's Dan O'Hurley.
Just a brilliant, brilliant cast. A really good cast.
Yeah, well, no, what I was going to say about Kurtwood Smith, what was funny about Kurtwood Smith was that he's normally like someone's father, or he's the DA, or he's like, he's normally like in a suit, basically. And in this one, he's sort of this slightly rough and tumble head of a drug gang, head of a murderous gang, you know, puppet of Ronnie Cox. Because it turns out halfway through the movie is that Ronnie Cox is using him to, like, do all his dirty work, basically. So he is linked intrinsically with the corporation, as you imagine most things in this society are. And to see Kurtwood Smith kind of being rough and tumble. And in fact, Ray Wise is in there, the Twin Peaks guy, who's also known as playing, like, bad guys in B-movies for the rest of his career.
Yeah, that's right. I love that guy. He's amazing.
But it's all these, like, middle-aged dudes, or people we all know as, like, middle-aged dudes, playing, like, street thugs, but they're not. They're all, like, middle-aged dudes, which is kind of funny, because Kurtwood Smith clearly has been bald since he was 20. But, fantastic, fantastic turns. I mean, you cannot... There isn't a weak link in the cast anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. It's just brilliant. Like I say, there are a couple of moments which I went like, that doesn't really work, which hadn't really struck me before. There is a very James Bondy, I will explain, you know, my evil scheme to you, which, considering what he says later on about, you idiot Robocop, he will have recorded it, he's a cyborg, you kind of go, well, why did you then tell him your evil plan at length, you know, when you hadn't killed him, you know, why did you tell him that, you know? There's a couple of little things like that, but it's very tightly made. It looks really, really good. It's really interesting when you look at the time it was made, just like a bestseller, the message it's giving out is very interesting. It just bowls along, and it's really entertaining. And it's got really good action scenes in it. You know, like it you have a guy in a robot suit fighting a stop motion thing that's got a soundtrack of squealing pigs and jaguar roars. I mean, those are the Foley sounds they use for Ed 209. Now, that would be very easy to look really poor, wouldn't it? You know, for you to watch that and go, oh dear. But it looks really, really good. Even now, it looks good. Stop motion photography has a certain quality to it where it doesn't quite look right sometimes, but it's still much more satisfying than because it has, you know, the life of the physical life of actually having texture. It's still better to look at than still half the CGI you see now, isn't it?
And what I like about it is that it's so designed, and this is another little bit of slapstick satire, that it can't handle stairs. that stares completely confounded.
Yeah, complete foxy, yeah.
But there's the other thing that's like a slight kind of brushed over, again, with this kind of constant ramping speed that the movie has, this gotta get on motion that the movie has, that completely makes it. It's completely glossed over why, if one big robot goes on a like kills a board member and it's crazy, why you'd go, okay, we won't go with that robot. How about that robot idea? Like, it's not it's not entirely sure. Especially, like, if they went, oh, no, it's going to be part organic, part robotic, and we're going to do that so that it has a human's moral engage or whatever. But they don't even do that because they're going to be like, no, we're going to make it part organic, but then we're going to wipe his memory and wipe this and we're going to program it and blah, blah, blah. So it is just another big murderous robot with a gun. Like, I mean, it could have failed horribly.
Yeah. Just to return to the thing which is strongest about it is the theme things. And it's not super clever. It's not like, you know, not that many beards are going to be stroked over Robocop, but it's just very satisfying that it does it in a nice, simple but strong way, these little themes it has through it. Like, the fact that this, the head of this all-powerful corporation is in, you know, even invites the crime lord to his own office to talk about how they're going to slice up, you know, how this brilliant new city they're going to build is actually, what it comes down to is, you know, a couple of crooks shaking hands about how they're going to divide up the spoils in an office. You know, there's a real, that's really strong, you know, and it says a lot about, you know, where the American dream failed at that time, you know, in a really good way. And also the Miguel Ferrer character is quite interesting because, do you remember that, you've ever seen that, there's a brilliant Futurama episode where a guy is resurrected from the 80s and they call him 80s guy and he keeps on saying, you know, we're going to do this 80s style, you know. And Miguel Ferrer is basically that character. And because, like you say, he has that thing with, yeah, that's what you do. You see an opportunity, you go for it. And it's interesting that the guy who, you know, like I say, he became this more likable character as they were writing the script. And the guy who chases that dream for his troubles comes to a somewhat sticky end.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing to mention is that the violence in the movie is, it's proper, you know, 80s R-rated violence. This was an 18 in the UK. It was a proper adult movie. And it's interesting that, and they've tried to get back to it recently with certainly making the action movies that are coming out more R-rated and more violent, whatever. But it's interesting that in the 80s, seemingly because there were so many of them, no one really batted an eyelid. They'd be like, oh, okay, so we're going to do yet another hardcore, made-for-an-adult action movie that also has bits in it that are, you know, ridiculously teenage to some extent. You know, like the big melty man at the end, while he is utterly grotesque... And he is utterly grotesque. The idea of, you know, toxic waste and gooey men and all the rest of it is an incredibly sort of teenagey kind of childish idea. But here it is put in a movie that was made entirely for adults. And there's also no feeling in these movies from this period of talking down to anyone. You know what I mean? There's no, when the news broadcast comes up, they're just presented as news broadcasts. And they're not like, oh, look, we're doing satire, by the way. They're just there. And it's really interesting because you do watch things now and just feel like everything is being signposted. And if it's not being signposted in the movie, it's being signposted by the 50 trailers that preceded the movie. And I just think that, you know, that's another thing. That's another reason why this decade in particular should be, you know, really praised to some extent. Because, you know, here is a big bombastic action movie with robots and melty men and, you know, all the rest of it. That's, you know, a big kids movie, really. But in it, they've put some real, you know, either gut-churning and or emotionally-churning violence in it. Because, I mean, when Murphy gets killed at the beginning, it's you know, it's harrowing. I mean, you've only known him for 10 minutes of screen time, but it's still like, oh, geez, you know, so much is done to him that it's not even that sort of... It is over the top, but for some reason you really
care about him. You know, you really feel every single, you know, shotgun blast or whatever. And it's just horrific in the real meaning of the word of horrific violence. It's odd how Verhoeven is able to turn what would normally be over-the-top, Peckinpah-ish, cartoonish violence and actually make you... And it's in Peter Weller's performance as well. Actually make you think, oh, gee, ah, oh, that's really horrible. You know, actually feel it. And it's just nice that there's this big kids movie that has all this adult stuff in it. And I like that. I appreciate it because... You know, guys don't really grow up, and we like movies like this.
I agree. The thing is, the massive achievement of it, and that fits in with what you're saying about, you know, the 80s movies having a real strength, it is that it at no point allows, you know, some clunky message or some greater morality to stop it being a sort of rip-roaring, fun, bowling along film.
Right.
But it manages to make you think just a little bit about, you know, the country and how it's going and everything else. It makes you laugh a few times. And, you know, and for that, it just comes together as a really strong whole. And it's really good. I mean, that's why it's sort of, you know, the main reason it bugs me is just that they're doing it again. But, I mean, I don't understand the whole remake idea. I think these are themes that, will carry on for decades to come, the themes that Robocop looks at. It only says a few things about it, but it says them well. And why not, you know, look to the what must be thousands of science fiction books that the studios have on their shelves and, you know, plot one of them away and come up with, you know, look at a new story and look at the issues in a new way. We shouldn't do an old man ramble about remakes again, but the fact that they're doing one quite bugs me. And it also quite bugs me that the cast is almost quite good from what I remember. Maybe you disagree on that, I'm not sure. But it just bugs me that they're doing a remake. Why do it? You know, do something new. You know, be inspired by it to do something new.
Ultimately, I've thought long and hard about this, and, you know, people can come at me with any single argument they want, and they're welcome to online. I will bat them all back with ease, because there is no real justifications for the remakes. Ultimately, though, what really pisses me off is that in the future, like 15, 20 years from now, when I'm wanting to talk about movies with someone, I'm going to have to go, yeah, the original. Yep, the original. No, not the original. Yeah, the 1987 one. Yeah, that is ultimately, it's like when people talk about Dawn of the Dead. I'm like, no, I'm talking about the one from the 70s, the actual one, not the fucking bullshitty, stinky stink studio one, the original one. That's what bugs me more than anything.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that bugs me is just there's so much new writing out there. You know, let it go and be inspired by it, but go and do something different. You know, and the other thing is that from what I've seen, the new RoboCop looks worse than the old RoboCop. He's sort of is he like black with a red visor or something? Like, yeah. Well, that's more modern. I'm like, well, no, it's not. That's equally 80s. You know, but just not as well done.
The new RoboCop looks like RoboCop from the 80s, Venom. And the car from Knight Rider.
He looks like
all
a sort
had
of Venom
sex.
RoboCop.
Yeah.
No, that's a really. He looks like a Venom RoboCop. That's what he looks like. It's very 80s, actually, from what I've seen. The pictures.
Yeah. They could go one step further and have the red light on his visor go wom, wom, back and forth, and have RoboCop turn up and go, I don't know, Michael. I think you should. I think you shouldn't take that lady home.
My chest. refuses to let people into Vera's building. I can't do that.
Like the Knight Rider car.
I mean, it goes without saying that we'd slag off the remakes. But so the important thing is to say, for God's sake, if you haven't seen it, see this before you see a remake, and then you'll decide that you don't really need to see the remake, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really beat this cast. I don't care who they put in the remake. You cannot beat this cast and the director and everything else. And like you say, I think you put it the best where you said they don't sacrifice the rip-roaring, bombastic, pacing, action, violence, all the rest of it with some big, like, tearful close-up message. In fact, there's hardly any... I mean, you know, Robocop's character throughout, like you say, is having these dreams and these flashbacks and whatever that mean that his memory is not completely wiped. There's some squidgy bit of brain matter back there that's still turning on and off from when he was Murphy, you know, and that will, you know, that informs him and makes him like a better cop, but at the same time it also informs him and makes him ripe for revenge and all the rest of it. But apart from like the brief scene with Nancy Allen in the warehouse where he actually just tells her to get lost, he just goes, leave me alone, and she does. She doesn't sit there and go, no, we must discuss it and we must talk it out in a big emotional thing. He just goes, get lost, and she's like, yeah, all right, I will leave him alone, you know. She understands.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the thing, they know the thing about the 80s filmmakers, it seemed a lot better at saying, number one priority is to entertain. Number two priority is to know this is the audience that I'm trying to entertain, and everything else comes after that, you know. And
but that there is anything else past those two things is also a breath of fresh air, because normally now it's just like how many things can we blow up, you know?
Yeah.
And last thing I want to say is Rob Bottin's makeup effects on when Weller does take off the helmet is phenomenal. I mean, it actually looks like his face is stretched across like a metal background thing.
It's brilliant. And Weller talks at length about how long it took to get in and out of this suit and everything. She's obviously extremely proud of it, even though he was bitching his way through the first 3 weeks of the film about it, evidently.
Well, he was losing 3 pounds of body weight a day in sweat.
Yeah, so they installed an air conditioner in the suit, which I just think is brilliant. If only he could have had like a huge box strapped to his back that was working air conditioning. He had to be sort of wheeled around on a big gurney. Like that would have been a delight to work on that film.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say about it is just that it's just in terms of it being Verhoeven's best film, because I've always loved Total Recall, but I think where Total Recall completely loses to RoboCop is in the casting. Obviously it's still got Ronnie Cox, but I just don't think any of the cast are as strong as they are in RoboCop, that particular group.
But if you don't cast Arnold in Total Recall, you don't get both him pulling an obscenely large red thing out of his nostril, which is phenomenal, and then him going like goggly-eyed and doing his Arnold screams on the surface of Mars.
Yeah, but no, but I've never had a problem with Arnie in it. I like Arnie in it.
You were talking about everyone else.
About the other people in it, like Sharon Stone, I don't think is very good in it. The guy who's like her, who is it who plays? Who was it? Because that's someone quite 80s as well, plays the sort of henchman of Ronnie Cox. I can't remember who that is.
Hang on, let's
But then, you know, the guy, the taxi driver on Mars, and a few other people. I just don't think it's a stronger cast. It's good. It is good. I'm not saying they're bad, but they're just not. It's just no way as cool as the RoboCop cast.
Oh, you don't like Michael Ironside?
Well,
he's Richter to Ronnie Cox's Vilos Cohagen.
I'm sure he's fun. I just don't think it's as good as RoboCop.
Okay. No, I mean, it's funny that Verhoeven, sort of what he's most known for outside of, you know, Sharon Stone's Snatch, is this movie, Total Recall and Starship Troopers, all of which share that, futuristic satire element. Yeah. None more so than Starship Troopers, which is, as I seem to remember...
I'll always have a soft spot for Verhoeven, because really like Total Recall as well, even if it isn't as good as RoboCop. And I've always loved Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers could never be as good as either film, because there's such a bunch of obnoxious brats it's all set about. I mean, that's part of the joke, but still,
yeah,
they are, you know, there's no one really to like in that film. But on the other hand, they do have, as the music of the future, they're all having a big dance to David Bowie's I Have Not Been to Oxford Town off... Outside, which was my brother Jim's favourite ever Bowie album.
Yeah, and also the trailer was Blur Song 2, wasn't it?
It was, right.
Yeah, the trailer with all the bugs coming over the hill of Starship Troopers was the, you know, woo-hoo bit from Song 2. Dude, let's take a quick break before we go on to bestseller.
Now available from Curiosity Quills Press, Death, the Devil and the Goldfish by Andrew Buckley, the audiobook. And it's no ordinary audiobook. Narrated by me, your diner host, and available on iTunes, Amazon and Audible.com,
Don't pass up the opportunity to immerse yourself in the delightfully madcap and hilarious world of Andrew's terrific writing by hearing me read the novel and provide lots of silly voices for all the characters. That's right! This is no straight, boring old audiobook. This man is a performance. But what's it about, I hear you cry? Well, from the Bahamas to Heathrow Airport to the rain-soaked streets of London, the dead have ceased dying. This is inconvenient for a number of reasons, but what's the real reason behind the chaos? In London, we find Nigel Reinhardt, a disgraced, confused, and gifted London police constable who owns a prophetic goldfish. In Ireland, the Angel of Death questions the value and position of his current employment. At Majestic Technologies, Selena McManus works diligently on a top-secret project. At the South Pole, there lives a very unhappy penguin. When the devil hatches a nefarious plot to take over the world by possessing a cute little kitty and seizing a factory of robotic Christmas elves, it's up to Nigel and his group of unlikely companions to save the world or die trying. Or both. So, want to know what happens and what all those characters sound like? Well, pick it up today and help support independently produced creativity. From Audible.com, iTunes, and Amazon, it's Death, the Devil, and the Goldfish, the audiobook. Buy it!
This is Jason Statham, and when I'm running around trying to build my adrenaline up, I listen to Dr. Action in the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast.
Hello, I'm Michael Winner, and yes, I may be dead, but in heaven, I'm still listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentators, my dear.
This is Nick Nolte, and when I'm taking cough medicine, I'm listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast.
Yo, Schwarzenegger here. When I'm done with Maid, I'm listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries.
How are you doing? This is Gary Daniels. And when I'm flicking through Bat Weekly, I'm listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast on my iPod or other such MP3 devices.
Wow, when I'm tap dancing to elevators and doing something crazy like cooking artichokes, I'm listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries.
This is slow. When I'm not entering an arm wrestling competition, I'm listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries.
Hi, I am Jean-Claude Van Damme, and when I am cuddling the puppies, I am listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries.
I'm Al Pacino, and the one fucking thing I'm gonna tell you is that it's not a fugazi. Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries, not a fugazi.
Hello there, this is James Hong, and I listen to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast. I was put on this earth to get it.
This is Clint Eastwood. And I usually spend my time listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast. You can download us from iTunes or on TalkShoe. Do it. Go ahead. Make my day.
Yes, hello. This is Sean Connery. And I've retired now. That gives me extra time to listen to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast.
And I'm Roger Moore. And when I'm done bedding three ladies at once, I like to relax with Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries.
Hello, this is Morrissey, and I like to listen to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentary Podcast. It makes me go, it's the eye of the tiger, it's the head of the eye.
Hi, I'm Steven Seagal. That's right, Steven Seagal. And when I'm done eating my breakfast of several large porks glazed with honey, I like to listen to Dr. Action and Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries. I've been doing it for 40 years now, and it makes me laugh in your face.
You know what I like, China? After I've done listening to Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid Commentaries, I like to go and discuss it over a beer.
Hello, 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 and for those keeping count, that's three hellos. Yes, I'm just interrupting your broadcast moment to discuss very quickly the exciting news that we have been nominated again for a TLA Cult Award. Yes, you may remember that about this time last year, well, hopefully you remember if you've been listening that long. If you haven't, go back and listen again. Relive the year through the Aftermovie Diner, then come back to this point probably a year from now and say, okay, now I understand what you're talking about. Tell me what you mean. Okay, we've been nominated for another TLA Cult Award. Oh my God, it's so exciting. This time last year, we actually won the award. I can't believe we won anything, but we did. And this year, we're in the running yet again. I can't thank TLA Cult enough. But if you want to learn how to vote for us and how to make this happen, I want you to go over to aftermoviediner.blogspot.com, where there is a easy-to-understand fool's guide to voting for us in the TLA Cult Awards printed right there. If, however, you're some sort of brainiac and you understand exactly how these things work, you could go to the following address. That's TLACult.com/TLACultAwards2013. So, TLACult.com/TLACultAwards2013. Yes, go to that address and scroll right down to the bottom where we are nominated in Best Podcast, Blog, whatever category, and put a yellow box around us. Hit vote, and you can do that as many times as you like. Oh, yes, you can vote multiple times. So hit the vote button, then hit back on your browser, then hit the yellow square around us again, then hit vote, and then go back on your browser, hit our logo so the yellow square comes around it again, hit vote, then hit back on your browser, hit the... Look, if you don't have the idea just yet, go to aftermoviediner.blogspot.com and you will find a blog that explains exactly that. And because the TLA Cult people were nice enough to nominate us not once but twice in a row and also allow us to win at least once, I would like to say, if you are in America and you need a wonderful place to go support, buy DVDs of all shapes and sizes, they've got everything there. They've got the latest Hollywood releases. They've got horror movies and cult movies and sex movies, and they've got all sorts of different movies. They've got movies for gay and lesbian people. They've got all sorts of different films there at the TLA website. So check it when you get to TLAvideo.com. Have a look around. See if there's a film for you. They cover all sorts of things. They probably cover things that, you know, Amazon would be a bit embarrassed to ship out. They have all sorts of weird and wonderful and dark and twisted and odd and beautiful and splendid films. So, look, go check out TLA Video as well while you're there. But ultimately, I really just want you to vote for the Aftermovie Diner. Let's do a Daniel Day-Lewis and let's win this sucker 2 years in a row. And then next year, let's win again. For all who have already voted, thank you very, very much. For all who are going to vote, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because I tell you, supporting independent, creative, internet-produced stuff is the best thing you can possibly do with your time. I honestly believe that. Support, listen, start your own stuff, be creative, whatever it is, but just support it. TLA is an independent company. We're obviously an independent podcast, so please support us. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. You'll be doing a civic duty, if nothing else. You'll feel good about yourself. You'll be able to sleep well at night. So yeah, vote. Thank you, thank you, thank you for everything. Back to the show. I took a little break there. I thought up another link between these two films. And that is the...
What's that?
Well, that is the link of movement, because Peter Weller did a lot of work, as he was discussing in the video, about doing movement for RoboCop and how he was set to move and blah, 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 and how he had to completely redesign that when he actually got into the suit and they had to do even more work on it because all the work they had done didn't work with the suit. And it's interesting that Peter Weller put a lot of, you know, time and energy and acting method into getting that movement, whereas Brian Dennehy in Bestseller, because his top half is so abnormally larger than the rest of his body, moves like that naturally. So there's that link.
Dennehy is a real freak of nature. I remember the first thing I saw Dennehy in was I was with my dad and Jim on a bloody canal boat, and he did, and there was, and we, but it had a little telly on it, and Dennehy was in a program as a serial killer, I think, and I thought he was absolutely brilliant. I was really, really young, but I just thought he was brilliant. And one of the things that I remember thinking about him, he's probably one of the first people I really thought, wow, that guy's got this incredible thing about him. Because he, like you say, he's a real monster of a man.
Yeah. He looks, to me, you know those, that image of like a guy in a barrel with like his arms over the edge of the barrel, holding the barrel, and then two skinny little legs sticking out of the barrel. That's like, that's Dennehy, only he's not wearing a barrel. That's just his body.
Yeah, the way this film. So we're about to talk about Bestseller.
Yeah, I'll give it a quick rundown. But this
film has to be seen just for shots of Brian Dennehy running, because I don't know what it is. It's not perambulation, is it? I mean, no.
What I like about it is that there's a sequence in the movie where he's running about these docks. And in order to cover up the fact that he, you know, it's Dennehy and he really can't run, they have him they have him slam into the car so that he has to kind of affect a limp. But really, I think that's just his real way of moving.
That's his actual limp.
Because
he runs like a man with two limps. So like a double limp. It's an amazing thing to see. I don't want to start off by mocking him, because I do think I really like Dennehy. He's got a very strange thing about him.
Yeah, no, he is tremendous. He is absolutely tremendous. But you wouldn't, you know, the fact that in this movie they attempt to try and make James Woods the harder of the two, it's quite incredible.
Well, that's the thing, yeah, because he's not running like a man with two limbs because he's fat. It's more that he's got normal legs with this sort of
enormously muscular torso.
His neck and head are just these like grease blocks, aren't they? There's like a couple of grease blocks stacked on top of each other.
Yeah, I mean, literally, you would not want to be bellowed at by Dennehy. I imagine being bellowed at by Dennehy would be one of the scariest things. I mean,
have an expression of saying like, oh, you wouldn't want to meet him down a dark alley, but if you met Dennehy down a dark alley, he would be blocking off the entire alley with his neck. You wouldn't just meet, he would be the end of the alley.
He would be the wall at the end. He is a dead end, literally.
I came in through the kitchen window. It was a hot night, the window was open. I had to hold up until 11 when the old man took his bath. The bathroom is a natural place for an accident to happen.
I wanted something more than I had. I wanted respect.
We have a natural bond, you and I.
No, we don't have anything in common. I don't have anything in common with you.
You can't let this one get by you, Dennis. Bestseller.
The subject is an assassin.
I removed the liabilities, and I provided some of the assets.
Do not move!
The author is a cop.
Hey, stay back! It's a police emergency!
I like you, Dennis.
Police!
But not enough to sacrifice the book for.
They need each other more than they can trust each other.
Cop. Killer. Two sides of the same coin.
Read all about it in my book.
Why don't you just be a good cop and leave the killing to me?
You like him, don't you?
Yeah.
And you're going to arrest him.
She's the clean part of your life, I'm the dirty part.
If they can survive to write the last chapter, they might have a bestseller.
Needs an ending.
So quickly then, Bestseller. It's written by Larry Cohen, directed by John Flynn. Larry Cohen is most well known for a series of 70s and 80s horror movies he penned. Stuff like God Told Me To, Maniac Cop, things like that. He then also has been a writer for hire in Hollywood and occasionally gets the odd script made. Stuff like Phone Booth, which was his, the Schumacher-Farrell movie about the guy in the phone booth, that was his. And what Larry Cohen does with his script, and why in a sort of similar way to Stephen King, this remains, even though it's directed by John Flynn, it remains a Larry Cohen movie over it being a John Flynn movie, in the same way that Stephen King, even if he doesn't write the script, it remains a Stephen King movie, no matter who directs it, is that Larry Cohen is good at coming up with concepts. Like, he's a very... here's my concept. I've knocked out a script about it. Have you done a second draft, Larry? No. Here's my script. Here's the concept. But I like him. I do like Larry Cohen's writing. I don't mean to knock. He also did the It's Alive series. That was his other famous series. But anyway, the concept here is that a big corporation had a hired killer who would get rid of the... Well, how does he describe it in the movie? It's not the enemies, but basically the things that would threaten the prosperity of the corporation. And James,
yeah, he says at one point, Dennehy says to him, corporations don't have people killed. And Wood says, corporations deal in two things, assets and liabilities.
Liabilities.
And he takes care of the liabilities.
Yeah, takes care of the liabilities. That's it. And James Woods, therefore, is this hired killer, and he comes to this cop who is. He has been involved in this heist back in the 70s, which became kind of headline news because these crooks robbed the evidence locker of a police station that Dennehy was working for. And he writes a book about his experiences. He becomes a big noise in the literary world and also becomes, you know, a well-respected cop. Although... when we then see him flash forward in the 80s, he's working undercover. Not quite sure how that works if he's also a world-famous author, because surely people are like, didn't you write a book? Aren't you a cop? Like, wouldn't that happen?
Yeah,
anyway,
doesn't work.
But anyway, he's working undercover. James Woods comes to him and says, I want to expose this corporation. I want you to write this book. You're down on your luck. Your wife's died. You're tired with being a cop. You've... burnt through your advances and you've got no third novel or whatever, however many novels he's written. You know, you need this and I need you and you're going to be my mouthpiece and blah, 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 blah. And then the movie takes off with James with the first few scenes with Woods and Dennehy. Woods is like proving to Dennehy through various spurious ways that he did kill people and this is where he killed them and this is how he did it. And then it builds and builds and builds. Basically, Dennehy's got to meet the head of this corporation and blah, 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 blah. And that's basically the setup for what is basically sort of Woods and Dennehy road trip. It's almost like the Woods and Dennehy road trip vacation movie with killing.
Yeah, and it's like you say, it's a concept and it of like Dennehy... Woods is taking Dennehy around, trying to convince Dennehy that what he's saying is true, isn't he, basically, on this road trip,
yeah,
by showing him where he did these various crimes and digging up various things he'd buried a long time ago and all this sort of thing.
And also trying to prove that there is a possibly shadowy conspiracy with this corporation. And
yeah.
And trying to sort of also, at the same time, what's the most interesting thing about the movie is James Woods. And I'm not just saying that because it's Woods and Weller. I'm saying it because this is the first film we've done where Woods is, first of all, he's not overplaying it. He's actually weirdly underplaying it. And secondly, while I went into it thinking, oh, it's just going to be Woods and he's going to be doing his thing and blah, 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 and he's going to be playing a hired killer and whatever, there are so many layers to his character that Woods is playing that I don't even know if it was on the page or not, but there's so many things going on. Like Woods
there's a lot going on.
Yeah. Like Woods is an actual sociopath. He's not just a hired killer. He's an actual sociopath. I mean, even though he's like trying to help Dennehy and, you know, he's desperate for Dennehy to be his friend. Like he keeps sort of weirdly wanting Dennehy and him to be pals. And not just to save his own hide, like not just to stop Dennehy, because Dennehy keeps saying, look, when this is all over, I'm arresting you. Not just to save himself from like Dennehy's wrath, but also you get the feeling that he's just so fucking alone that he wants this one human connection. But then at the same time, trying to like get his hands on the manuscript and trying to figure out what Dennehy's writing about him, trying to make sure that he looks good in the book. He is excessively violent and cruel to all these people who are in Dennehy's life. So it's this really weird thing that's going on in the movie, and it's fascinating.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's so first of all, it, it is a good movie. It has it's probably fair to say that it's a pretty low budget effort. It's pretty basic, and it rests on Dennehy and Woods going around and their very strange relationship. I have to say, and I don't want this to put you off because it's very much hinted at throughout. But I really thought there was, you know, a strong gay subtext to Woods's, you know, such a path. I really, really did think that,
right.
Which is doubly disturbing when you consider, you know, the specter of Woods and Dennehy getting it on. You just don't want to, basically.
No.
But there is there's quite a lot to back that up, because you were saying about how he's so desperate for Dennehy to be his mate. But he says things to him which are, you know, which made me go, oh, bloody hell. Like he says to him, like, oh, that's all I am to you, a freak, and stuff. And things like, oh, you like me in spite of yourself. There's a scene where he discovers that Woods is the one who shot him previously, and he sort of beats Dennehy, gets up and begins beating Woods like a sort of basically being beaten up by a tree, really, isn't it? And Woods just sort of seems to be enjoying it. Then they wind up in a hotel room together. Woods has this girl in the other room, comes out and says something like, oh, I can't satisfy her. You know, you get in there or something, which is all a bit like...
And, well, no, what's really is the idea of Dennehy going, okay, then, and then, like, lurching, which he doesn't in the movie. But if you imagine him, like, lurching over to the bed and going, all right, then, darling.
Yeah. He also buys Dennehy a watch, like a special watch as a present.
Yeah.
And he goes over, you know, you were talking about being cruel to the people in his life. Well, actually, he protects his daughter, but the one who Woods beats up, and not to turn this into a thesis on the gay subtext of bestseller, but the person he goes over, the one he's particularly cruel to, is Dennehy's girlfriend. And he says, you know, why do you deserve all these pretty dresses? What makes you special?
Right,
you know, and throws all these dresses down, and
it doesn't put me off, dude. I think the other thing that Larry Cohen does, and maybe I was slightly unfair, but the other thing that he does is he does, you know, load on the subtext, and I think anything we took from it, he would be happy with, whether it's actually put in there or not.
Well, I think that's very much there, but the main thing about it is, like you say, is Woods just does this really good performance. I mean, there's a couple of moments in it which were, I'm sorry, but still are classic Woods for me, such as there's a moment where Woods sings.
Terribly.
Which is completely mad. He absolutely murders some tune, but it goes on for a while. And he's singing in this sort of strange, boyish falsetto the whole way through. And then stops and then goes and has dinner with Dennehy. And you're like, what was that? What was that about? And there's also, he also does one of the main Woods acting things, which is the clenched fist, the Woods clenched fist. Now, that gets employed an awful lot, where he brings it up in front of his face when he's particularly articulating a thing. And I noticed that come out in their first meeting. Woods was shaking that fist all over Dennehy's face. And like you say, it's a really creepy... He's like a very likeable but very creepy sociopath who wants to bring down this guy who he calls a modern robber baron from Capri. I think his name's Matlock or something.
Yeah, David Madlock.
Yeah, and there's this sense of Dennehy and Woods sort of becoming almost friends, even though Dennehy, you know, would never sort of admit that, while Woods, you know, sort of secretly goes about being incredibly cruel and mean to various people and killing various people as well.
Yeah, I mean, he kills everyone he meets except, like, Dennehy and Dennehy's daughter.
Yeah. It also had a major... A moment I can only describe as, with a very private joke to us, as a Royce moment.
Yes, it does have a Royce moment in it.
Royce is a Jim Belushi movie, and there's a famous bit in this...
With Miguel Ferrer in it.
Oh, no way. There you go. More thematic, there's a moment in Royce where famously there's this big action scene going on, and Jim Belushi is coming out to rescue his daughter. Daughter's kidnapper's back is turned, but daughter yells Royce at the top of her lungs.
It's even worse than that. It's his son, and it's on a train, Royce is wrestling with the bad guy up the front. And a son is, like, edging along the train. And all the son has to do is just stand still and say nothing. And the son is like, Royce.
And instead he yells, dad at the top of his voice or whatever. Yeah. And this happens again in Bestseller. Basically, the daughter is responsible for what happens to James Woods, flat out responsible by not listening to him and then sort of running, screaming at the baddie.
Right.
Instead of running away from him, she runs right at him. And so he grabs her and pulls into her and puts a gun to her head.
Yes. And not so only that, James Woods has told her, well, to be fair, though, James Woods does march into the room where she's being held, shoot the guy who's holding her, just flatten her, like, out on the bed so that she's in a room with a corpse, and then goes, yeah, just stay in here, and then, like, shuts the door.
Yeah, fine. I can understand leaving the room, but not running...
Running down into the arms of the bad guy. No. And you're completely right. She goes, Daddy! And then runs straight at Madlock, to which you're like, you fucking idiot. All you had to do was...
It would have killed everyone else in that building. Yeah. I mean, she can leave in a million different ways.
I'd also like to point out, he does kill a lot of, like, besuited henchmen, because it's very much an 80s movie in which the henchmen wear three-piece suits for reasons. So, like, surely if you're doing hench work, the last thing you want to be doing is wearing a constricting three-piece suit. But no, they're all dressed to the nines. And they're having this sort of... Because the one thing that comes out of this movie is how corporations, in order to, like, maintain some semblance of public favour, occasionally do this sort of what's seen to be, you know, charity work or whatever. So he donates, like, a bit of public land at the beginning of the movie, this Madlock. And then at the end, while Woods is, like, going around and murdering these henchmen, he's doing it in front of the eyes of a party full of children.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Which sort of adds this whole, like, you know, I don't get sensitive about this stuff. I know it's just a movie. But it does add this whole aspect of, so you did just gun down five people in front of a party full of children.
At a kid's party.
Scarring them for life. Well, not only that.
Obviously, he doesn't kill any kids, but, you know, it's a bit mad.
Well, not only that, but the moment, this was what was really bizarre, is the moment, like, the henchmen who are in the grounds of this big house by the water are aware that Woods is, like, on the premises, they all start running for the house while taking out enormous handguns and, like, waving them around children, only to then promptly get shot in the face and fall in the swimming pool where there are children. It was a bit obscene, but then, I mean, it was fine.
Yeah. And the whole, you know, you can tell that the sort of, It is linked to RoboCop in this sort of, you know, corporations are, you know, can be these sort of monsters. But, you know, it's not anywhere near as strong. Woods does have this character of, you know, I'm a sort of corporate assassin, basically. I mean, that's what he is. He's a corporate assassin. And that is, you know, a nice little tweak at the, you know, tweak of the nose of big corporate America or whatever. But that's kind of it. And the fun of it is watching Denihan Woods barrel around the country on the trail of Woods's mad killing sprees of the past 20 odd years or whatever. And there's even, you know, one particular thing, you know, one note I made was, like, love the Denihan Woods gunfight where they're running around a laundry shooting pistols at people. Like, that's brilliant. And the only thing I could say slightly let me down about it was I could have definitely gone for some more action here. I think this is where, you know, like, a cigar-chomping 80s executive could have come in and said, well, it's a good movie, but you need a couple more action scenes in there, because I didn't think it was quite action-y enough.
No, and but I think that what Larry Cohen's doing is he's writing the story and writing the characters and writing the you know, the message of it more than he is like, oh, we need to put an action beat in here, we need to put an action beat in there. Because ultimately as well, and for people who haven't seen it,
well, there are spoilers, well, there are spoilers coming up, don't you know? Spoilers coming up, and we would hate for you to go. So I'm just gonna sing this song, so you know that spoilers are coming along. So if you don't wanna know what's in it, then just turn the show off for a minute. 'Cause there are spoilers, spoilers
Spoilers coming up, don't you know? Spoilers coming up, don't you know? Spoilers coming up right now.
But, you know, the other thing the executive would have, no matter how many people he's killed, that you would never have lost Woods in the end. Like, Woods would have limped out of the hospital at the very end or something.
That's true, yeah.
And, like, him and Dennehy would have been best friends or something like that and gone for a pint together or something.
Or married.
or married. Dennehy and this tiny little pink pinny preparing scrambled eggs.
Which was definitely the female of the couple.
I see Dennehy as the subservient and Woods as the mad. Well,
Dennehy, the other thing I thought was really great about Dennehy is he has an amazing stare. Because he's fixing Woods with this sort of or pushing your luck stare for about half the film, and it's a quality stare. There's no doubt about it. It's really really good. And he's a very big, intimidating sort of guy. He kind of reminds me of the guy out of Bad Day at Black Rock. Is it Spencer Tracy? I don't know. Like a big honourable, cop kind of a thing, which is quite a rarefied character, but a really good one.
And although Dennehy has played many a brown suited cop in his career, it litters his career like James Belushi's beige-suited cop. In fact, I'm surprised Dennehy and Belushi didn't do, slightly brown beige-suited cop.
Yeah, sequels. Or just open up, a store called brown and beige. Everything beige.
Everything a cop could need. But I'm surprised there isn't a Dirty Harry-like series in Dennehy's career where someone didn't just go, give that man a hand cannon and have him go around, cleaning up the city or whatever.
Because I do think he's good. I wonder why that never happened for him. This is a good little movie. It's a nice accompaniment to RoboCop, I'm sure. And I again, there are another couple of Woods and Weller that would make a nice, a nice double bill of an evening. They really would. One of them is very action-y and futuristic, it's got good effects, and one of them is more about story and characters, and they're a nice pair.
The standout for me about Bestseller, and it does come down to what I said about Woods, I think it's probably the closest performance to this is probably him in Cop, in terms of like there being a slight sociopath bubbling underneath the persona that he's putting out in front. But this one, I mean, this, out of all the performances of Woods, this was probably my favourite if I was going to be giving him a serious critique. Like, if I was going to say, okay, you want to see why Woods is a respected actor, this film, because there's so many layers to what he's playing and there's so many things to what he's doing. It's not as fun by any means as some of the other performances that we've covered, and they're all good, but I was impressed and unnerved by him, which is exactly what you're meant to be. You're not really meant to like him. You're meant to be unnerved and a little.
His first appearance, I did laugh out loud. the way he first appears in the movie was unfortunate in many respects for the performance that's come, because the performance that comes is very accomplished and very cool. But the way I won't say how it happens, because if you haven't seen it, you really should see it. And the way he appears in the film is ridiculous, and almost like he's a sort of Ghost Woods or something.
Now, that's a film I could go for, Ghost Woods.
Yeah.
Woods goes back and torments his former co-stars by just being ghostly James Woods in the room.
Yeah. A good little pair, and well worth a watch once again. I have received from Love Film my copy of Digstown.
But no, I've got to watch those. And then I'm probably going to start alternating them, because I've got a couple of other things that I'm doing as well. And then once we've got, because we've got two more shows definitely planned of this.
Yes.
Digstown 50/50 and Of Unknown Origin Salvador. So we don't need to start thinking about it yet, But, you know, it would be great to carry on this. Like I say, I've got a couple of other guests that I'm having on that are doing certain things that I'm going to alternate our shows with. But I would love to carry on this, you know, at least once a week or once every other week recording. So try and come up with some other ideas.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Because the best thing about 2013 for me, and the best thing about doing this series for me of Woods and Weller stuff, because every week I'm trying to find another reason why I'm loving doing this, is it's really testing me, my ability to just, and I'm finding it easier and easier as I get older and less like violently opinionated, is that just sitting down and watching a film and not going, no, I don't want to watch that because it's this, or I don't want to, you know, I don't want to watch a sci-fi movie. I'm now like, or I don't want to watch a, you know, a movie starring this person. I'm finding it a lot easier to kind of go, no, I'm going to sit down and watch this movie. Because I wasn't necessarily in the mood for Bestseller any more than I was in the mood for RoboCop. But I sat down, put them on back to back, loved both of them for completely different reasons. And it was like a really good night in front of the telly. And that's what I'm enjoying. So more of the random picks, the better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, have a think about what you'd like to do after this. Maybe a Miguel Ferrer series of movies or something.
Well, actually, I did think that Ferrer and someone else beginning with F might be something I seriously tried to figure out. Because I thought he was so likable in RoboCop. I really, yeah. really liked him.
Maybe we start off with Royce. I don't know. No.
Oh, God.
The last
I will definitely have a look.
The last question I was going to ask before we ring off, it's been announced today. I know you don't really like the Expendables movies, and I'm not going to talk about them directly, but it's been announced today that Tom Sizemore is in the running for the villain in the third one, which is a bit of random fucking casting. But I was intrigued because you weren't a huge fan of the actual film, but I know that you are, especially delving around in the 80s and stuff, you're a fan of those types of movies, or certainly those kind of the better ones of the 80s. I was just intrigued. If you were going to put together like a man on a mission movie, who would be your cast of characters?
Well, first of all, I really like Sizemore. I love Sizemore. I like him because of The Relic, which was a brilliant late 90s B movie with about a monster taking over a museum. I mean, it was completely weird and but very entertaining. I liked it a lot. I don't know. I mean, I could have gone for the Expendables. I really could have done. I really don't get along with it, but I do like a lot of the actors in there, and they have used a lot of the people that I would use. I mean, you know, Peter Weller comes up really high for me on most things now, but you know, he'd be a definite candidate. I mean, other people who are around, I don't know. One thing that I'd definitely like to see is something like, because again, it's a movie which I never actually really got on with that much, but what's the movie with Moore and Burton as mercenaries? What's that? Wild Geese.
Oh, Wild Geese. That's an amazing film. I love that film.
No, I'm not that. But okay. I could definitely go for, you know, wrenching out a load of sort of in their 50s English actors. I mean, there's one guy who I saw recently. I mean, this isn't really answering your question, but in terms of people who I wish did more, you know, the BAFTAs were on recently, and Tim Roth staggered on with a very sort of distracted look on his face, and you know, read out one thing without, you know, really being that interested in it. And I thought, oh, Tim, I really, really liked Tim. You know, from Rosecrans to Skin and Dead and Reservoir Dogs, I always thought he was such a good actor. I'd love to see him do more. Otherwise, I don't know.
You could put Tim Roth in a sort of British Mercenaries Abroad type movie. That wouldn't
be... Yeah, he'd fit in there nicely. Who else?
In fact, I'd quite like to see kind of like Gary Oldman, Liam Neeson, Tim Roth, Ray Winston.
Neeson has tested my patience. I actually saw Taken 2 when we were up at a friend's.
Oh, it's a big test of patience, isn't it? It's not good.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I could definitely put together a good wild geese cast. I'm sure I could. I mean, who would you have? Is there anyone missing that you'd really like to see?
Oh yeah, I mean tons. I mean, I don't know why Kurt Russell hasn't been in one yet. I would love to see him in one.
Yeah, that would be good call. I saw you saying that on Twitter. That's a good call.
I personally would like to see Steven Seagal, if nothing else, just as like in there for 5 minutes spouting some nonsense. That's always fun. There's a whole bunch of like straight to video. I'd love to see Cynthia Rothrock in there, who's a sort of female action star from that era. You know, they're my big ones. I'd like to see Kurt and Cynthia Rothrock definitely in the movies. Someone mentioned Keith David, which would be awesome. He's the big dude from They Live.
I tell you who I'd love to see is... I don't even know if he's got... I don't even know if he's still alive. I don't know. Ian Richardson. You know they're doing House of Cards with Kevin Spacey.
Yes.
I can't recommend enough
the original.
Anyone who hasn't seen it to watch the British original House of Cards with Ian Richardson. He does the most brilliantly sinister turn. And I read some review recently saying, oh, you know, it's very much of its time. It's all about Thatcher. It doesn't really fit now. You know, he's this sort of posh, well-spoken bloke. And I said, sorry, what planet are you living in? That's exactly who's in charge of the country now. Like, it makes more sense than ever, really. But what's really splendid about it is I honestly don't believe, and I love Kevin Spacey, I honestly don't believe that he'll be able to do as good a job as Ian Richardson. Ian Richardson talking into the camera and making you part of his schemes was one of the most delightful things to watch, and it's definitely worth having a look. And I would love to see him in a Wild Geese as like the sinister businessman behind their plan or whatever. He would be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I'd happily, if you want to go
Robbie
even...
Robbie Coltrane could go in there somewhere.
Robbie Coltrane would be incredible. I mean, if you're talking about
Mel Smith?
A crazy British Expendables. That would be, yeah. If you're talking about like old thesps as opposed to action people.
Love to see Bob Hoskins do something.
Yeah, except he's retired from acting now, isn't he?
Has he? Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's not Alzheimer's. What is it? It's Parkinson's.
Oh, dear. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think he's got what Fox has got, Michael J. Fox has got. But obviously he's a lot older getting it, so it's going to be more troublesome for him. I think I'm right in saying that. It's not Alzheimer's, I think it's Parkinson's. You know, you would have to put Michael Caine in there. You'd have to have Roger Moore in there, even though he's like barely stands up now. But you'd have to have Roger Moore in there. See, the trouble is, I know he's dead now, but I would have loved Michael Winner to have come out of retirement and directed it. That would have been incredible.
Yeah, that would be something, yeah.
Winner bouncing around going, right, come on, everybody. Let's all get in line. Come on, get your guns. Let's go. Right at the camera. It would have been amazing, but alas, sadly not. I don't see them doing a big, you know, British Expendables thing, unfortunately. I mean, I really want to see...
No, I don't think they will for a minute, but
no.
But that would be...
They should do.
Because the Expendables, I think they're pretty much... They are sucking in everyone into that vortex. I think it's a very good call on Kurt Russell, though. I think he should... Perhaps he just doesn't get on with them, I don't know. But he'd be a great call for that. So that's what I'm saying. I'd just like to see what the British version of that would be like. Because there's so many just brilliant people who don't really get any work now.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that there's this big thing made because the first three action movies that came out, the Schwarzenegger, the Statham and the Stallone ones in the States, all bombed. And then Die Hard has done really well. And someone wrote, even though it's nowhere near as good as the other three, but someone wrote an article basically saying, you know what, if they were making Expendables 3 or if they were making Rambo 5 or they were making Rocky 7 or whatever it was, those movies would be popular because there's a built-in franchise there, and basically crowds going to movies are idiots and lazy, basically, because they don't want to see like an 80s throwback movie. They want to see like an actual movie. And there's been a lot of talk ever since the first movie came out of why was there never a Tango and Cash 2. And I think if he's not going to be in the Expendables, do a old Tango and Cash sequel. That's the next franchise that Stallone has to resurrect. And get Kurt Russell doing something we actually want to watch him doing. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I'd really like to see that, definitely.
And make James Hong the villain again, just to have James Hong in it, because he's amazing.
Yeah, why not, yeah.
Anyway, sir, that's been another fantastic show. Thank you for joining me in the diner again. And we will continue to do this.
Yeah.
And I love the T-shirt, man. It looks really good. I'm so glad it printed off.
Thank you very much. I have a Susan Sarandon's monkey is dead, and I'm very happy about it.
It's very cool, yeah, which you can now pick up on the Aftermovie Diner Cafe Press site. So it's all very cool. I've got lots of those Cafe Press T-shirts, dude, and as long as you wash them in cold water inside out, they stay as good as they did the day you bought them. They don't lose images like those old ones we used to get printed up. They're pretty solid. So anyway, man, happy birthday again. Glad you had a good day.
You too.
Glad you got the gift. And talk again next week.
Yeah, take care, man. See you later.
All right, man. Bye-bye. You've heard him on the show before. You've even heard him playing piano on some of the songs that we've done. You've heard him discussing Don Dola, Woody Allen musicals, and lots of others besides. Yes, it's Mr. Nicholas Consol, the master of the keys, the commander of the keys, one might say. This is a new feature. Every week, or at least when he can manage it, he is going to try and provide us with an interesting take on film music. So he's going to pick a score from one of the films that we're doing, and he's going to interpret it through his own wonderful way, and he's going to present it to us here, and we are going to incorporate it into the Aftermovie Diner. And this week, because I think that what he gave me was particularly special, I've reserved it as the final piece of music for the show. So please sit back and enjoy a myriad of wonderful and weird themes from RoboCop the film, done by Dr. Nicholas Consol, Commander of the Keys. Here we go.
Second Unit Podcast Men. The podcast you've just been listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include Drunk on VHS, We Came from the Basement, No Budget Nightmares, The Aftermovie Diner, Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid, and Bloodbaths and Boomsticks. Take one podcast into the shower. Don't be a blithering idiot, Alan. We can give you the multiple podcast cleansing system all in one place that your hair deserves. Our programming is available across all platforms, from iTunes to Podomatic, TalkShoe to Stitcher, so you have absolutely no excuse. Listen today, and a free naked person of your choice will be shipped from Thailand to your door in a matter of weeks. The Second Unit Podcast Network, bringing you the action and leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Bloody hell. Who does a girl have to blow around here to get a decent beverage?